This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. The most memorable interviews and listener calls from the week that was on Fight Back with Libby Znaimer. Welcome to the best of Fight Back with Jane Brown.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the Sunday edition of the Best of Fight Back. More of what you want to hear from the week that was. Libby began the conversation with our recovering politicians on Tuesday by offering congratulations to two of our regular panelists, Sherry DeNovo and Lisa Raitt. They, along with former Premier Kathleen Wynne, asked the Trudeau Liberals to commit $1 million to aid Israeli investigations into sexual violence perpetrated against women in Israel during the Hamas terror attacks of October 7th. And on Monday, Foreign Affairs Minister Melanie Joly made the funding announcement during her trip to the Middle East. George Smitherman is a former Ontario Liberal cabinet minister. Janet Ecker is a former Ontario PC cabinet minister. And Sherry DeNovo is a former Ontario NDP MPP.
It shows the power of coming together in a post-partisan way about issues. I mean, something that, you know, I managed to get most of my bills passed that way when I was at in the Ontario legislature, and it clearly works federally as well. So, I mean, I look forward to more cooperation, particularly around women's issues with other women from other parties. But yes, it's a good thing. And hopefully some healing will come from this for those who, if not victimized, watched those who were. I mean, we're talking about people who have serious issues with trauma right now. And so, again, healing and obviously, you know, a real shining light upon using sexual violence as a weapon of war.
Janet, this really goes a long way to showing credibility and to countering this wave of denial. That seems to be one of the key reasons that people are very excited about this, even though the dollar amount is small.
Oh, yeah, it is very small. But listen, let's give credit where credit is due. I think it's a good thing. I think nonpartisanship can work from time to time and work well. So, yes, it's a small amount. Hopefully the government will see a fit to do more. But kudos for the money, because it'll help. I mean, we can only imagine the trauma that these women and their loved ones have gone through. We hope it's a good interest that's caused the government, the federal government, to do this. But the UNRWA has been part of the problem and being proved to be part of the problem. And yes, there's an investigation. So they had a way to say, okay, we're not going to do anything until an investigation is complete. And then they go and do it. And it's not because of problems. And yes, there are problems getting aid in. But giving money to UNRWA, as Libby has pointed out, is just replicating problems with that aid getting in. It's not going to solve the problem. So the naiveness of some of this, you know, our federal government's decisions, it boggles the mind, quite frankly, in terms of what they're trying to do.
George, so what do you make of the Liberal government's handling of this?
What I think it speaks to is the overarching concern that many people have about the humanitarian circumstances that have unfolded in Gaza, and that there are probably very limited vehicles to actually deliver aid through. So I'm sure it was driven by a sense of necessity, notwithstanding that there are obviously a lot of concerns raised about their and some of the people affiliated with them participation in those events. I think that there is a significant degree of concern amongst many in the population with respect to the implications on the humanitarian ends, and, like I said, fairly limited means of delivering aid. So perhaps this is what's driven it.
Sherry, there is fortunately a big, huge ship in Cyprus has started to make its way to Gaza, but the holdup in Cyprus is also being blamed on Israel when it's not Israel.
There's precious little aid getting through, and I think that's what motivated the government, and that, and what really is motivating a lot of international empathy and sympathy. You know, there's no sight of the release of the hostages in all of this. And, as you know, Libby, I mean, there are many thousands on the streets in Israel protesting Netanyahu's handling of all of this. So I think that's where the move came from, maybe peremptory, but it's just in the absence of what, you know, what can we do? What's getting through? Not a lot.
Sherry DeNovo, former NDP MPP for Parkdale High Park, George Smitherman, former Ontario Liberal Cabinet Minister, and Janet Ecker, former Ontario PC Cabinet Minister. This is Zoomer Radio's Best of Fight Back. I'm Jane Brown. The numbers keep growing, and they are staggering. GTA food banks have hit record highs in the number of clients they are serving. Toronto's Daily Bread Food Bank saw over 300,000 clients last month, a jump from the 215,000 it saw in the same month last year. Operating costs are rising in lockstep, from $1.5 million spent yearly to buy food before the pandemic to $22 million last year. On Tuesday, Libby was joined by Daily Bread CEO Neil Hetherington to talk about the dire situation.
It's astonishing. It doesn't read correctly. You know, the fact that we've gone from $1.5 million to $22 million, and in just about 3 months' time at our year end, we'll be presenting to the board of directors a budget of $29 million for food. And by and large, housing remains the number one concern. And we saw Deputy Prime Minister Freeland talk about that on April 16th, that the federal budget will be specifically paying a lot of attention to the affordable housing crisis that we all feel. And then the other thing that I'm hopeful for in the upcoming budget is the candidate disability benefit. In June of this past year, it was passed into law, but it was just a framework and there was no money behind it. And if you're disabled in Canada, specifically Ontario, you receive about $1,300 per month to survive on. And the poverty line is $2,300. The average bachelor apartment in Toronto is about $2,000. So folks are underwater immediately, even though they can't derive their income from employment.
What about donated food? So I remember a time when the big grocers donated a huge amount of food. Has there been a drop in that?
So there has been a decrease in the amount of donated food, and we will at Daily Bread remain an opportunity for each of the grocery stores to divest of their wealth if they would like to continue to donate to the organization. We have seen individuals, you know, making a drop in one of the iconic yellow Daily Bread bins across the city. That has decreased, and it's understandable. I mean, you think, I don't know, it was only about 6 months ago that you could buy a pack of pasta for about $1.25. It's about $2.25 now, and so it's understandable that people are challenged to be able to do that. The good news, however, and there's a little bit of good news, is that there continues to be a rallying of support for Daily Bread across the city so that we can provide the food to the some 200 food banks that we support. You know, folks are seeing the real issue of a lack of affordable housing and precarious employment. I think what is frustrating to me is there's a massive challenge, and if there were 300,000 folks without hydro, we'd send the army in. There are 300,000 folks who need, 1 in 10 Torontonians who has to make use of the food bank, and we are not taking the legislative steps required at all levels of government.
Often on the routes that I drive regularly, notably to Princess Margaret on College Street, I pass the north, the Fort York Food Bank, and there's always a huge lineup, which is very upsetting to see. And the people in the lineup are well-dressed. They look like they might be heading off to their minimum wage jobs after they get some food.
Yeah, I think you're entirely right. It is a sad state of affairs when somebody who has done everything right still has to go to a food bank. Here's a stat that I think is startling. The reality that 59% of food bank users have a post-secondary education. Bill Clinton used to say that if you go to school and you get a job, you work hard, you'll be fine. That isn't true, not only in the United States, but in Canada anymore. Folks have gone through what they ought to. They may have accumulated debt. A $50,000 wage with a child, perhaps, and paying $2,400 for a one-bedroom apartment, you realize very quickly that your disposable income is gone.
Daily Bread CEO Neil Hetherington in conversation with Libby on Tuesday. This is Zoomer Radio's Best of Fight Back. I'm Jane Brown. Coming up after the break, 4 years have passed since the start of the COVID pandemic. We reflect on the anniversary next.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Good isn't good enough. Make way for the best of Fight Back with Jane Brown on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. This past Monday, March 11th, marked the 4-year anniversary of the start of the COVID-19 pandemic. Try to remember how it felt 4 years ago as the world was literally shutting down and we began to live very differently for well over a year before most people were offered the COVID vaccine. And even then, there were endless restrictions around in-person work, doctor's appointments, restaurants, and travel. Even though it's been nearly a year since the pandemic was downgraded, we are all still feeling the effects, some of them lasting, around the COVID crisis. Libby discussed where we've been and how far we've come with the medical record panel. Dr. Elisa Naiman is a family physician and founder and medical director of the Medical Station in Toronto. Dr. Malcolm Moore is a medical oncologist at the Princess Margaret Cancer Center, and Dr. Fahad Razak is Canada Research Chair in Healthcare Data and Analytics at the University of Toronto.
The things that make me worried is that as the pandemic has receded, some of the most harmful parts of the pandemic have persisted. So the rise of misinformation is really, really significant. And, you know, we talked, I think, last week or the week before about measles cases. That's just one manifestation of this rise of misinformation. So the reluctance of people now to not only get a COVID vaccine, but measles vaccines for their kids. This is misinformation in action. A depleted workforce. We're seeing the shortage of nurses and physiotherapists and physicians across the board. This is a workforce that really took a battering this last 4 years. And how long will it take to improve? I don't know. And then just the general erosion of solidarity. It almost feels like a different world in those early times of the pandemic when people were banging on their pots and supporting healthcare workers and we were all in it together. Think about how divisive these ideas now feel or divided society feels compared to that. So look, this was an experience that killed more than 50,000 Canadians, you know, more people than in World War II. I'd like to think that we will head to a better, more resilient future in the country, a stronger system of research, a stronger system of pandemic prevention. But today in 2024, we're not there. I think, in fact, the system is more depleted than it was in 2019.
Are we going to be prepared, Malcolm? I mean, have we learned enough to be prepared for the next one?
I'm hopeful that as the dust has settled on COVID, there are thoughtful, sensible people like Fahad sitting down with the decision makers to figure out how do we handle the next pandemic? Because there will be another one, there's no question. And, you know, some of the things that were done, mistakes were clearly made, but at the time, you know, things looked pretty desperate. And so you can kind of understand some of the things that were made, mistakes that were made. But I'm kind of hopeful that there will be, you know, non-political, non-adversarial working groups planning for the next pandemic so that it won't be so chaotic. Final point, I would just like to say, what really hit me during the pandemic was the social isolation of people who are seriously ill, where you had people with advanced cancer who were in hospital, who had little to no visitors, and you know, people in nursing homes who were basically isolated for 2 and 3 months. And I'm hopeful that the next time one comes around, we'll find a way to do this without isolating people, because I think the trauma from that is quite significant.
Alisa, I think that the pandemic really changed, especially family practice in terms of virtual care and use of technology became much more acceptable. Also, I noticed it really increased when the government gave billing codes for it.
The government, a couple of months before, had allowed people who were within these rostered models, so in these family health organizations, that you could use the government online platform and you could have patients booked, so you would be able to do some visits not by having people come in. So I had the technology I had already set up, but the system was so bad that then secretaries would have to walk the people through how to get online, and it was honestly like it was a disaster. And then I think later in the week or the following week, then the government allowed us to have phone calls, and that basically like saved things, and we were able to communicate with patients and at the same time get paid and be able to pay our staff. And I just remember it being like, okay, how do I make this decision? I'm going to affect people's ability to seek care. I'm going to have people who aren't going to be able to earn an income, but what do I have to do? And it was this Wednesday that this whole thing happened. It's when, you know, Donald Trump came on and had his talk on TV and the NBA shut things down. Everything happened that Wednesday. And to look back and go, oh my gosh, this has been 4 years. I can't believe how things have changed. And you know what? Virtual care, I think, is important. And I think the pandemic sort of pushed things ahead by 5 years, because I think the government really did not have a desire to bring in virtual care.
Dr. Alisa Naiman, family physician and founder and medical director of the Medical Station in Toronto. Dr. Malcolm Moore, medical oncologist at the Princess Margaret Cancer Center. And Dr. Fahad Razak, Canada Research Chair in Healthcare Data and Analytics at the University of Toronto. This is Zoomer Radio's Best of Fight Back. I'm Jane Brown. Canada's most profitable and most hated grocery chain is at it again. Loblaw is testing receipt scanners at 4 of its locations in an attempt to combat theft at its stores. The idea is that shoppers who use the self-checkout option are required to scan their receipts to prove they paid for their groceries. Libby discussed the development with Ellen Roseman, consumer advocate and journalist.
It's interesting the way it was covered by the CBC, where they talked to a number of people at these stores where it's being tested. And this is an issue right away. If it's being tested, why aren't people even aware of it? It was just kind of put in, and they were discovering it as they went along. And many people were going through the gates and setting off alarms because they didn't know that they had to scan the receipts, or even if they did, they probably might have had trouble figuring out how to do those receipts. But in general, I think that they talk about being held a prisoner, you know, and I have Loblaws near me at DuPont and Christie, where they do have a big, big area with about 20 different self-scanners, nothing else, and a gate that you have to go out. There's no scanner there yet, but I felt like it was like a zoo or something, where we were all working hard, and then they had a couple of people in there to help us. But what are they going to do if you refuse to go through the scanner? They can't hold you there. You're not a prisoner. They don't have a right to detain you, especially if they have no proof that you did anything wrong. So they're taking the approach that every customer is a potential thief, and they're making sure that if you scan the receipt, at least they'll know that you bought something and that you're not sneaking out with goods that you shouldn't have. And they're denying that. They're saying there's nothing to do with ordinary people. This is organized theft.
I wonder if it's even legal.
I don't think so, because they have no proof or even suspicions that you've stolen anything. They'll just say this is part of their routine, and maybe they'll start putting warnings on the front of the store saying that you shouldn't go in if you have a concern. Also, I think in a public safety issue like what your guest was just talking about, that they would have to just say, forget it. We're going to not worry about scanning the receipts. We want you out of the store quickly.
I guess somebody would have to change the technology that's set up.
There must be a way to deactivate. You know, like they have the shopping carts that freeze, and sometimes you're stuck in the store with this freezing one and you can't even get to the cash, so they'll have someone to come and unfreeze it.
A lot of things about self-checkout are egregious, mostly that this company charges enough and makes enough profit, so why am I doing the work of people that they are going to or have already fired to save money?
I actually had a problem one day in that store with the pricing of an item, and I had to go back to the shelves three times to check it. And each time I had to go through this gate, and it was so long. It was like way on the other side of the store, and it just made things much more complicated.
It's all computerized from Galen Weston's head office and the people who are actually working there, unless it may be the owner of the franchise. They can't do anything about it.
In fact, when we were in Shoppers, we were working with a youngish fellow who was helping us out. And then a couple of times he was looking at the self-service checkout and trying to manipulate it. And he'd say, if I were able to talk to Galen Weston, I would tell him this. So they're getting frustrated, too.
Consumer advocate and journalist Ellen Roseman. You're listening to the best of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. I'm Jane Brown. Coming up, what you had to say about the week that was and the Fight Back Knockout Call of the Week.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Zoomer Radio, pulling no punches with the best of Fight Back with Jane Brown.
Fight Back with Libby Znaimer has the most informed guests on the week's hot topics, and we also rely on you for your valued opinions. Here are some of this week's best calls. Barry in North York phoned about how he is no longer a Loblaws shopper.
Another reason why I switched from that store to Walmart, it's cheaper. $6.95 for delivery, and also Eat Impact. So now I don't have to put any more money into Galen Weston's pocket, and that makes me so happy.
Brad in Holland Landing called about having to scan your receipt after self-checkout at Loblaws.
I'm just curious what the Ontario Fire Marshal's Office and local fire authorities think of, you know, keeping people captive in the store. If there is emergency activation, you know, have to be evacuated. How is everybody going to get out, you know, one at a time, show your receipt?
Lewis in Toronto phoned in during our segment on grocery store theft.
In the area where I live, I've noticed like in the last 2 years, the shoplifting has gone up considerably. Like when I go shopping, I see packages opened everywhere, in the washrooms, you know, on the shelves, bottles open, people drink the stuff, leave the empty bottle on the shelf. They have put in security guards, I noticed about a year or two, but they don't really check any receipts. They're just standing at the door there.
Bill in Toronto says he feels differently about the U.S. election and in particular Joe Biden's State of the Union address.
Well, your last commentator, when he said feisty and energetic, that's what I always look for in my politician. When I'm going to cast my vote, those are the top two things. And as far as him being feisty in that speech, I think they must have had the guy drugged up. Let's look at this realistically. Hang on. You know, the guy tripped upstairs. He's fallen down. He's walked around stages. He's gone to shake people's hands that aren't even there. You know, he's tripped over himself up on a stage. He's sat up there and mumbled incoherently. I mean, more times than anybody can count. How the hell can anybody even, if this is, you, that's what you want to put out to run the strongest world in the country, to lead the world?
And now, Fight Back's Knockout Call of the Week.
There were a lot of great calls this week, but the winner of the Fight Back Knockout Call of the Week is Daryl in Toronto, who phoned about the recent time change back to daylight saving time.
I would like to know what the similar statistics are for every Tuesday after a holiday long weekend, because I would think that they're probably just as bad, if not worse. I don't think people get more sleep on a holiday weekend. And I don't think anyone's going to want to get rid of holiday weekends.
That does it for this week's Best of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. If you'd like to qualify for the Fight Back Knockout Call of the Week, phone us noon to one weekdays. Or if you have a comment, email us at fightback@zoomer.ca. Follow us on X at Fightback Libby and call our Fight Back voicemail anytime at 416-367-9636. I'm Jane Brown. Join us again next weekend when we'll round up the best of Fight Back.
Best of Fight Back is produced by Jane Brown, Ziv Hadi, and Dan Christakos. Technical production by Ian Robertson. Executive producer, Moses Neimer. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.